Hello, and welcome to the TV Movie Rewind Podcast with Matt and Todd.
Hi, everyone.
Today we have a special guest. I'm very excited and delighted he can be here. He is kind of the reason this podcast exists. He is noted film historian and podcaster extraordinaire, Rob Kelly of the Fire and Water Network.
Welcome, Rob.
Hey, boys. Thanks for having me. I don't know if I like the idea of being blamed / responsible for this podcast, but okay, we'll go with that.
Well, you know what? It's real. Not that Todd and I were ever estranged in any ways, but we've gotten closer together since, you know, we started this.
Right. You know, plus, we're just talking in a legal sense. Week.
We're talking off more often. Even our dad, who's down in your neck of the country, you know, closer to him now too. He's very thankful that he's got entertainment provided by us every week.
That's amazing. That's all. I mean, I would imagine that's got to be really fun to have if you're a parent to hear your two sons, you know, being able to hear them like that on the regular. That's really fun. By the way, it's ironic because Shag and I are now very estranged after 12 years of podcasting together. So it's good that, you know, you guys are a better example of growing closer together.
So you're like Bud and Lou, the lady.
Hopefully without the tax problems.
Yes. Yes. And I hope you're not, you know, we're not dragging you down because we are not noted film historians. We are rogue film historians.
Right.
Ne'er-do-well film Renegade. Historians.
Yeah.
That's the best kind of film historian, really, you know. Right. Going rogue. That's cool.
Leather jacket, everything, yeah.
Well, this week we are discussing the Abbott and Costello movie, Hit the Ice. Mr. Kelly is a very big Abbott and Costello fan. Mm-hmm. So he was the perfect guest for this episode. I believe your favorite is Meet Frankenstein?
No. My favorite of their films is, I think I would have to say it's Buck Privates. I mean, Meet Frankenstein is certainly top five, but Buck Privates is probably still my favorite.
See, I enjoy Buck Privates, but I find that to be one of the ones where they're almost secondary characters in their own movie.
I agree, and I can see why people would mark it lower for that reason, because it's like, oh, great, the Andrews sisters are singing their fifth number. But their routines in that one are just, like, they still make me laugh. Just, and, like, Boxcars and, you know, obviously the drill routine. Like, it's just, every time I watch it, I just, I don't know. I'm amazed. That movie's, you know, what, 80 years old? And I can still laugh at it. So and it's probably the one I've seen the most. So probably just as a pure nostalgia, I'd still give that one the nod. But it's, you know, I love Meet Frankenstein. It's a classic.
Well, this one is my favorite. I think one of the reasons is because it's the one of the ones where Bud and Lou really seem to get along as characters in this movie. You know, often Bud seems to be going out of his way to mistreat Costello. This one, there seems to be a genuine friendship, and Abbott's a lot more friendlier to Bud and willing to help him out. And I know that wasn't how they were. I know there was, you know, some bad blood, unfortunately. But in my mind, I always hoped that they were really more like the characters of Flash and Tubby than the unfortunate reality that we're forced to live in.
Right. I'm relatively new to the game. Like, I never really watched them. I didn't even know Matt was a fan until relatively recently.
And I was a closet fan.
Yeah, like I didn't know Matt was a fan until relatively recently. Like, I never actively avoided them, really, but see, some of my friends are like super into the Three Stooges, and I tried. I just never really clicked with me, so I suppose I never really thought much. But I guess the first one I saw of theirs was probably either Meet Frankenstein or Meet the Wolfman, you know, one of the monster ones. And then I didn't really think much about it until Matt had picked up a collection, started watching them, wanted to watch some, and I believe we watched this one first, and I loved it. So I'm a big, like, Looney Tunes, like, classic Looney Tunes fan, so I didn't really, like, you know, I guess I always kind of knew or heard where, you know, a lot of the inspiration had come from those cartoons, but now I can straight up see it, and it's good stuff. I think, I mean, a lot of the jokes and the wit and the writing, like it really holds up. It was a lot of fun.
All right. First of all, Todd, not to be a jerk on as a guest, but there is no Abbott and Costello Meet the Wolfman. That movie does not exist. But what makes me laugh about that is, did either one of you guys ever read Warren magazines growing up? Like Creepier, Eerier, stuff like that?
Yes.
Okay. So, Matt, so, okay, you remember the back pages, right, of the magazine, every magazine of Warren that had, you know, like 5-6 pages of merch you could buy? T-shirts and back issues. I'll tell you, I was such an Abbott and Costello fan that back then in the day, they would sell, you know, like 8mm highlight reels of Abbott and Costello movies and other movies, right? And for whatever reason, when they sold them in that format, they would retitle them. And I didn't know that. So, like, I grew up thinking I had seen every Abbott and Costello movie, and then I'd see Warren selling, you know, Abbott and Costello Go to Pluto. And I'm like, what is that movie? Huh. There's other Abbott Costello movies I haven't seen. Damn it. How do I find them? And of course they don't exist. They're just retitled clip reels of their other films. So Todd, that's why I'm being a jerk, is that when you said Meet the Wolfman, I'm like, I wish there was Meet the Wolfman. I wish they had done that one.
That no, I think I'd Meet Frankenstein. Yeah.
I think right. But I was like, oh man, I wish there was a dozen more of those. You know, I was like, oh man, I was so disappointed to find out that there weren't 30 more Abbott and Costello movies for me to watch. They were just clip reels that they were just named in different ways. I was like, oh, well, all right then.
Well, there's Abbott and Costello Go to Mars, where they do not go to Mars.
They do not go to Mars, right.
They go to Venus. Why not just say that's where they go?
Right.
I don't know. I used to have a collection of cassette tapes that had recordings of their routines, with Buck Privates, the dice game being one of them. And
oh, you love
know,
that.
I love that bit myself. You know, I those cassettes went the way of, you know, pencil repair way too many times, and you know, anybody who's had cassettes know what a pencil repair is. And you know, I was late on replacing them on CD, so I only have a couple of the stuff on CD, but that's just some of the my favorite routines are Hurt You Drive, Making a Picture, where Bud wants to, they're going to have Costello trained to be a stuntman. And the constant thing is like, oh, no, it's the experience you need. It's the experience you need. You're going to be the stuntman for Van Johnson. And he wants to know why he doesn't get to make out with Veronica Lake. You know, why does Van Johnson get to make out with Veronica Lake? Because you're the stuntman. I did not routine justice.
If I ever had time to create an Abbott and Costello podcast, like a dedicated show about their movies, I would call a turn with the rest of them, because I'm so obscure, that's no reason, that'd be a terrible title, but I just think about, when I think about my favorite routines, I just hear Bud yelling turn with the rest of them, just that makes me laugh every time.
There's one of the routines I have was, obviously, you know, again during one of their live shows, where Lou Costello saying the wrong lines, and he's like, oh wait, what page are we on? He starts to hear pages, and everybody starts laughing hysterically. He's like, okay, I found us.
That's awesome. I love that. I wish Saturday Night Live could be that loose sometimes, you know, when you think about it, you're like, wow, I haven't, like, that's like brain melting stuff in the 50s, that you just have a guy be like, what page are we on? That's so cool.
I love listening to, because you can find a lot of their old shows, you know, out there on the old time radio podcasts that are all over the place. And, you know, there are varying qualities, but one of the episodes I have saved is, of course, has the Who's On First routine, because Bud has been, Lou has been asked to join the Mets. And it's also got the whole, you know, bat made for slaughter and glove made for fella. And, you know, like, what fella? you know, the fellow who plays for the Cleveland Indians. Well, there's nine people playing for the Cleveland Indians. So it's one of my favorite episodes that I listen to quite a bit. But all that to aside, we are here to talk about Hit the Ice, which was directed by Charles Beaumont. The first he directed with Abbott and Costello. He would go on to direct several more at the end of their film career. Not Meet Frankenstein, but I believe he did direct Meet the Invisible Man and Jekyll and Hyde. But this one was, I guess, originally titled Oh Doctor, which kind of makes sense, but I think Hit the Ice is a far better title.
Yeah, it's a better title.
It features the adorable Ginny Sims and Johnny Long and his orchestra. And I'm just going to say right up before we even start talking, Ginny Sims wins my Whit Pistol Award. Sure. Just because she's one of those, she's always got this adorable smile on her face, like she's having the best time of her life. And I don't know, just found her so charming.
And yeah, she just kind of floats through the movie.
I wish I lived, because in my mind, there was a time where people just kind of would stop and start singing a song.
Hmm.
And fortunately, there would be four backup singers nearby to join in at just the perfect time. Obviously following poor Ginny Sims around as she's trying to enjoy the resort. Okay, so the movie begins in a hospital, and we find out that three gangsters are planning on robbing a bank across from the hospital, and their plan is to, for their leader, Silk Fellowsby, to pretend to be sick and in the hospital so that they will have that as an alibi when they run across the street to rob the bank and run back in. But before they can do that, they're waiting for two extra men from Detroit they've never met before. And they're going to know who they are, because when they come in, they're going to give the password, "Is the doctor here?" Which in a hospital is probably not the best password you could go by. Now, a nurse, Silk's nurse, Peggy Osborne, is very suspicious of him. She knows he's not sick. He's obviously faking, but the doctor, who, whether you go by the movie, is named Dr. Bill Burns. If you go by the end credits, he's Dr. Bill Elliott. I don't know what that was about.
Yeah.
But he's all like, well, what do you know? You're just a nurse.
Right. And also, it's against regulations to tell the patient their temperature. Was that a thing in the
40s? Yeah, well, that made me like, what? Since when is that a thing?
That seems a very peculiar regulation to have in a hospital.
They were very serious about HIPAA violation back in the 1940s.
I guess so.
You know, they had
your own HIPAA, like, is that HIPAA violation if you're told about your own medical condition? I don't understand.
Everybody was being told in the 40s, loose lips sink ships.
Can you tell someone else your temperature? You know? Yeah, I just thought that was so strange. Like, what happens if you tell them? Like, what's the problem?
Yeah, it seems a bit odd. I don't know if it's one of those where they're worried, like, oh, if my temperature's that high, you know, they'll either fake it or I don't know. Right. It seems like pretty much nonsense. But he was very upset about it when he left. Yeah. So then we cut across the street to our two heroes, Bud Abbott and Lou Costello, who are playing characters. Bud is playing Flash, and Lou is playing the unfortunately named Tubby. But they're street photographers, where they basically go around and take pictures and give you a card and say, send that card along with 25 cents and we'll mail you the picture. You think about, that's again, like the milkman, that is a job nobody can do nowadays, because everybody has a camera phone and can take a picture of themselves whenever they want. It's kind of neat to put yourself back in a time where getting a picture of yourself was a novelty.
Right.
So they're out there, you know, doing their thing when Dr. Bill Burns just happens upon Bud, and, you know, they grew up in the old neighborhood together, and Tubby's around here sometime, and we get our first bit of slapstick with Costello has been stuck in a garbage can because he needed his own little dark room to change the film. Clever. And the friends reminisce, and they see fire trucks going by, so they know there's a fire nearby, and they're all excited because if they can get photos of the fire, they can get a job with the local newspaper. So their old buddy, the doctor, says, well, I can help, and he manages to score them an ambulance ride to the fire, where more slapstick ensues, and, you know, Costello accidentally gets himself on the ladder, raised up to the burning building. He's thrown from the ladder, and again, in an unusual move, because I think in this movie, Abbott throws a stretcher underneath Costello to catch him, and then runs to him and is very concerned about his well-being. Whereas I think in most other movies, he would have let Costello hit the ground and gone over and yelled at him for not getting the picture. What are you doing lying around there for? Don't you know we got to get photos of this fire? This is, again, why it's my favorite movie. And they got some pictures, which I can only imagine played on the front page of the next day, that said, many perish in fire while lard butt fools around on ladder. Okay, that fell flat. So they end up back at the hospital. Costello is, you know, checked out, but he's wheeled up outside the maternity ward, and there's a bit of a joke that he's just had a boy, which I believe is a meta reference, because in real life his son Lou Costello Jr. had just been born prior to the filming of the picture. So I wonder if that was just a little way of him celebrating the birth of his son.
Oh, that'd be nice.
They wander into Silk the Gangster's room, asking, of course, if the doctor is there. And now my favorite routine of the movie comes along, because they start, you know, as photographers, like, oh yeah, we shoot people all the time. Well, how do you do it? Well, we just line them up in front of the wall and we shoot them. Unless we shoot them in the back of the, well, how much do you charge? Oh, we charge the same for everybody, except for the police. How much do you charge for shooting the police? Oh, the police, we do it for free. The reason we don't charge for shooting the police is because that way they'll leave us alone when we're shooting everybody else.
Okay, now I have to comment on this sequence, right? This run of them talking about, you would never, ever associate Abbott and Costello with edgy humor, right? That is just so not anything, even when they were famous, right? Nowadays they are kid-friendly. But a whole run where you are joking about killing policemen, that would not fly nowadays. Really wouldn't.
Shooting people in the back of the head, yeah.
Even the gangsters are taken aback by the sociopathic, you know, approach to, like, you know, well, we don't need you to be shooting. We just need you to cover us when we come out of the bank. Because now they're a little concerned about, you know, who are these guys they're hiring.
Yeah, I like the one who's like, shooting them in the back of the head doesn't count.
No, we can't charge for that. So they get the job to cover them as they're coming out of the bank. But I got to wonder, what happened to the two guys from Detroit? Did they go into the wrong room, ask if the doctor was there, and end up as orderlies at the hospital for shenanigans of their own? We never find out what happened to the actual two gunmen that were supposed to be hired.
I kept expecting them to show up and somehow be a part of the movie,
Yeah. So, anyways, they show up for the bank heist. They figuring they're just going to, you know, take pictures of the guys coming out. And, of course, you know, Costello is distracted by a woman walking by who's dancing like Elsa as she sings Let It Snow. They take the pictures as the guys, you know, run along. But, again, they don't really understand what's going on until they enter the bank after them and start looking for the bank teller, which, you know, they use their little teller routine where he's like, I'm looking for the teller. Tell her what? Not tell her what. Again, I'm just going to butcher it if I go on. You know, you got to see these movies. They are just so much fun and so much pleasure to watch.
They've done that routine before. They did that a couple times in a couple different movies. The tell her nothing, I'm gonna tell her. That old bit.
Tell her in a bank?
Yeah. Well, the piano bit they've done a couple of times too. That will.
Oh, that out. Yeah, yep.
So they quickly realize that, you know, the bank has been held up, and if they don't get the heck out of there, they're going to be accused of robbery. And a police officer comes in, unaware of who they are, and says, "Whoa, don't you know your door's still open? Well, want me to lock that up for you?" And through some, you know, shenanigans, they end up escaping from the bank, but their pictures do end up in the paper as the men wanted for the robbery.
I love those caricatures that you see in the paper. I just love those drawings. I'm probably just somebody at the Universal, you know, on the lot that was their job to be one of the illustrators. But those are just like really good caricatures of the two. That could have been, you could have seen those things as like a poster, you know, like they were always using illustrations of them for the posters. Like those are really sharp little drawings.
It does look like it's right out of their, you know, publicity, you know, material.
Yep.
So back at the hospital, the gangsters start playing out their plan to go up to the mountain lodge that Dr. Burns has just taken a position at, you know, to kind of get away till the heat's off. And since they know Nurse Osborne is on to them because she checked the room while they were out, but she was unable to convince the doctor that they went anywhere because they got back before she was able to bring the doctor back. So Silk decides he's going to hire the doctor and the nurse to be, take care of him while they all go up to that lodge to for him to rest and recover. And they made a joke that when they were all in school together, you know, the doctor and Bud and Lou, and we will find out later they also went to school with Johnny Long, who plays himself as Johnny Long in his orchestra, that Burns was the dumbest kid in the class. And I'm beginning to understand, think that, yeah, he's not too with it because he's so easily led by, you know, everything. Regardless, they're all going to go off to the mountaintop ski lodge to, you know, for Silk to recover. Meanwhile, Bud Abbott and Lou Costello are looking to lay low, and Costello is told to pack up their clothes. They need to get out of the city. They need to run and hide. No, we don't. We don't need to run and hide. Unpack that bag. We're going to stand and defend ourselves. We didn't do nothing. We're innocent. Unpack that bag. But, you know, even innocent men go to jail. So we get a whole little bit of Bud, you know, forcing. This is much more the Bud Abbott I'm used to of him, you know, demanding, you know, Costello do something and driving him crazy. And, you know, magically he's able to one final time whistle all the clothes back into the bag as they decide they're going to get out of town and they're going to follow. They're going to figure out where the gangsters are going, follow them, threaten that they have the negative of them robbing the bank. Unfortunately, what all they got was the back of their heads, which they can't charge for, and Costello standing in front of the bank. But they're going to bluff their way into, you know, settling up with the gangsters to return the money and clear their names. At the train station, they meet Ginny Sims, who's playing a woman named Marsha, who was an old girlfriend of Silk. It's not entirely clear. She's definitely acquainted with Silk, hasn't talked to him in a while, but she recognizes him. She kind of knows who he is, but she's saying, "Well, I'm going up to this lodge that you're going to, but I'm going there as an entertainer with Johnny Long." And it's also set up pretty quickly that Ginny Sims and Johnny Long are in a relationship, a romantic relationship. Bud and Abbott sneak on to the train because they don't have any money with them. And, you know, they sneak on with the orchestra as the orchestra is going on. You know, I'm first base, I'm second base, I'm third base. And Costello kind of blows the whole game by claiming he's the shortstop. And that's their little routine there.
I don't know why that makes me laugh. I just, you know, I just.
It worked for me.
Just laugh at it. Second base, third base, shortstop, shortstop. I don't know. It's like if you try and describe it like you're doing, it just sounds terrible. But when I watch it, I laugh. Like it's just timing. I don't know.
It's the way. It's also the way Costello can say things. Mm-hmm. You know, just the inflection he can put in his voice and his little noises and sounds, like his woohoo and, you know, all the other, you know, little things that he kind of puts into his comedy that really just gets you a laugh out of it. Plus his facial expressions, you know, he's so good at all of it.
The little smile and tap that he gives it when he comes out of the trash can explaining why he was in there, and he gives this little like kind of like smile and tap that makes me smile every time too.
Breaking the fourth wall, looking at the camera and winking, and yeah. So they make their way up to the ski lodge. The gangsters are on to them being followed, but at this point they think they're still being followed by the two hitmen they think Costello and Abbott and Costello are still the two hitmen looking to get the money they were promised. As they get up there, you know, Johnny Long, again, we mentioned they were friends with growing up with Johnny Long, and Johnny Long gets them jobs at the place as waiters. And Costello, again, very, very enamored with Ginny Sims, which is completely understandable because I was enamored with her through the whole movie, wants to impress her, but he can't figure out how. And Abbott comes up with a little bit. Well, you know what I'll do? We got a record and a vitrola here. I'll go over there by the piano. You sit by the piano, and when you say all right, I'll start the record. You stop playing the piano. And again, Bud is genuinely trying to help out his pal and meet this girl. You know, he's not being roped into it. He's not, you know, he's genuinely trying to help out his friend. And as you can imagine, you know, again, the password of all right, you know, because at first it goes off without a hitch. Costello sits down at the piano, says, all right. Lou starts playing the record. Costello says, all right, again. Lou stops and gets up and walks over to where Ginny is sitting. And she says, that was all right. Well, then Bud stops playing the piano again. And again, the physical comedy I don't think Costello was that big, but, you know, because he was short in stature, he kind of, you know, had that more. But he was a very physically capable performer. I mean, his slapstick, the way he runs around and throws himself all over the place, you know, I'm amazed he wasn't, you know, he was probably black and blue quite often, but I'm amazed you don't hear that, like, oh, he had to take a week off because he, you know, broke an ankle or sprained an ankle or cracked a hip. The way he throws himself into the piano every time Bud accidentally starts the recording again.
We knew that that Lou had a penchant for taking furniture home because he felt like they were underpaid, and therefore that gave him the right to literally just abscond with set furniture. I wonder if he took this piano home. I wonder if he's like, the family could use a piano. I'll just take this. I'll take this. When we're done with it, I'll take it.
That's fantastic. I didn't know that. He would just take stuff home.
Apparently, he did take some of the patio furniture from the set, from the poolside patio furniture. He did end up taking home. And then, you know, when they came to shoot the next day, Charles Lamont was like, where's the furniture? And
so wait, he didn't even wait until the shoot was over to take
that? No, he took it home at the end of the day. Yeah,
that's amazing. And
Lou would refuse to cop to it, but he finally came to a compromise. Like, Lou, bring the furniture back tomorrow. We'll film all the scenes we need to do, and then if it disappears again, I don't care. And I guess that's the compromise they worked out.
Obviously, Charles Lamont established quite a rapport with them, because it sounds like directing Lou Costello was a giant pain in the ass.
Yeah.
You know, so anyone, now I know that a lot of these kind of studio directors, they weren't given the choice what they could direct. You know, the studio told them, hey, go to this building and you're directing Abbott and Costello tomorrow. But at the same time, for Charles Lamont to do as many Abbott and Costello movies as he did, he must have figured out a rapport with those guys, because otherwise that would drive you insane. Right. Having a guy, it's like Mark Hamill's like, hey George, I took a Tauntaun home. Like, what? what are you talking about? Like, what the hell
are
you, you know?
Well, he did more after this with them, right?
Yeah, he did. I think he did 7 or 8 more after this.
Jeez.
Yeah, exactly. So
he got this one because the original director was fired because he wasn't getting along with Costello.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, it's just like, I would love to know what kind of rapport he had with them that he could just, you know, because Lou continued to act kind of badly, but obviously Lamont was able to get it shot and get it done and whatever, you know, but like, Lou especially just sounds so difficult to deal with. I mean, whether on this film or Time of Their Lives, where he decided like halfway through the filming, hey, I want to switch parts with Bud, you know, you're like, what the hell are you talking about? So yeah, poor Charles Lamont. Yeah.
I wonder what he stole to get the other director canned.
Who knows?
Refrigerator or something.
Well, unfortunately, you know, Ginny Simms gets on to their little piano routine, and she kind of, you know, lets down, you know, tears into Lou, and storms off, and we get another break of the fourth wall because Costello starts moving towards the pool, and you think he's going to fall in, and he stops right at the edge and looks at the camera and says, "You thought I was going to fall in, didn't you?" And sure enough, almost every time I watch this movie, I forget and do indeed think he's going to fall in.
I love that. I love that bit so much. He just looks right at the camera. I don't know. I'm just so charmed by this stuff.
And for all we know, he was supposed to fall in and decided he didn't feel like it that day and pointed to the camera and said, "You thought I was going to fall in, didn't you?" And Charles Lamont kept his job by saying, "Whatever, that works. We'll put that in the movie instead."
Yep. Something else I thought about when watching the scenes of them at the resort is, like, the sets are huge. Like, they're much, like, they're like three stories high. And it's just, there's something about, I know that they probably used those sets for, like, Universal probably used those sets for, like, 10 other movies. You know, they probably had Deanna Durbin coming in 2 weeks later and shooting a movie there, and probably, you know, Nelson Eddy and Jeanette McDonald. But there's something, I don't know, like, I think we've lost something in that, like, they don't reuse sets anymore. So, you know, I mean, you look at this movie, right, an Abbott Costello movie, its budget was probably very low. The shooting schedule is like, you know, 12 days. You know, they shoot a whole movie in basically 2 weeks. And yet these sets are massive constructions. And they're incredibly impressive. And you're like, well, that's because Universal was like, well, we'll shoot 9 movies on them. You know, yeah. And they're not expecting people, nerds, to be sitting there picking it apart and going, hey, that's the same ballroom from this or that or whatever. But that way they got their money out of it. But it gives a cheap movie like this such grandeur that they go to these sets and it's like, God, they look magnificent. I mean, these look like the greatest vacation spots you're going to want to go to, because like they could fit 10,000 people in these swimming pool halls.
With a massive skating rink as well. I mean, that is a huge, I think it appeared to be more than Olympic size to me.
Yep.
It was just a massive skating rink where, you know, in another scene where Ginny Simms sings a little song about the slap happy polka.
Yeah. You're telling me they arranged that? They really filmed these that quickly?
Oh, yeah.
I may be exaggerating a little, but not a lot. Their shooting schedules were absurd how fast they turned around these. I mean, you look at their career. And it's like, it's only after this that Lou came down with rheumatic fever and they had to take a whole year off. Think about that, a year off. And to Universal, that was an eternity. Nowadays, it's like, what?
Sure.
You know, some directors make one movie every 7 years or whatever. But like, they cranked out like 5 movies in 1943. So, I mean, they're just banging through these things.
Wow. I mean, that is impressive because they have all these like song and dance numbers that they pull off. I mean, that alone, I would have thought would have taken some time to arrange.
Well, again, you got Johnny Sims and his orchestra.
Sure, they're professionals, but still.
And Ginny Sims, they know what they're doing. So I'm sure it wasn't, you know, too difficult for them to, you know, just like set up and go.
That's very impressive.
The skating scene, however, you know, first, you know, like, again, they're all kind of dancing and skating together while Ginny Sims sings, you know, and first you clap and then you slap. It's the slap happy polka. And, you know, you get this. And again, like we mentioned, this was probably the first, you know, people would get to see these elaborate skating routines because, you know, most people didn't have televisions. And unless you live somewhere near where they had, you know, where the Ice Follies would go on tour, in order for you to see, you know, these elaborate choreographed skating routines, you had to get them in the movie. So Bud accidentally ends up in the middle of the skating routine. And again, we get to see his physical ability as he is spun around. I mean, I know a lot of it is, you know, and it's obvious that it's, you know, faked footage, but it's silly, but it's funny. And again, the way Abbott throws his little woo-hoo, woo-hoo, as he's being spun around and crashing into the, you know, the vending areas on the edge of the rink, you know,
just those down falls he takes there.
Yeah,
I can feel him.
Ends up being sent sailing over a fence, doubled over backwards, and you know those had to have been fake legs coming out of the snow behind him, because otherwise he was bent in a U shape.
Right,
terrifying. So they finally catch up with the crooks, and they all basically, the crooks have two plans. They want to get rid of Bud and Lou, and they want to get rid of the nurse, and they'll probably have to get rid of the doctor as well, because, you know, they're all onto them. So they end up all, they make this plan where, you know, Bud and Lou say, yeah, we have the negative and we'll trade you the negative for the money, but, you know, not here. And the guy says, well, we'll meet up at, I have another cabin up the mountain. We'll meet there later. And he also arranges for the Silk also arranges for the doctor and the nurse to be brought up there later. Bud, Lou, and the doctor all collaborate on, you know, catching the crooks, because, you know, when the doctor sees Bud and Lou there, he was like, oh, you guys are on the run. I thought those pictures in the paper looked like you. But Bud explains the situation, and they work out a plan like, okay, we're going to go ahead of time and scout out the cabin, and then that we'll take care of the thing. You know, we'll be there for when you arrive later. We'll get the money. We'll all leave and we'll clear our names and we'll hand these crooks off to the police. So Bud and Lou get to the cabin early, and we get some, you know, shenanigans as you see it. You, again, this is something you would see in Looney Tunes a lot, when they're trying to get in, but the window's locked, and, you know, Lou goes in through the front door, opens the door, goes around, unlocks the window, comes back outside, and it's like, oh, the window's unlocked. You know, they're afraid. There's a bit of fear from the bearskin rug. You know, Costello's, you know, nervous. He doesn't want to go near it, but, you know, Bud's like, it's bearskin. It's there's nothing here to hurt you. And so they discuss, like, okay, we'll wait in here. And, you know, when they come up to divide the money, that's when we'll spring out. When they go to sleep, we'll come out and get the money, and then we'll go turn it in. And Costello starts saying, you know what? I think we should go after them. I'll give them the one. I'll give them the two. I'll really whip them. And then the best, my favorite line of the movie comes from Bud Abbott: you couldn't whip cream with an outboard motor.
That's a good line.
Unfortunately, things go wrong, and the doctor and the nurse end up there before they're kind of ready. But Bud Abbott and Lou Costello come out pretending to still be the killers that they've been pretending to be, and Costello has a banana in his pocket and he starts pointing it like the gun, and he says, "Oh, we'll take care of these guys." And he gets the gun from one of the gangsters and he hands it to Bud Abbott and says, "You go take these two outside and you use all those bullets on them. You come back with this gun. You come back in here and the gun has any bullets left in it, I'm going to use it for you on you." Which I think is a fantastic, gangster line. You know, something you just heard Edward G. Robinson saying.
Right. Like, that works in a really dark gangster movie, too, yeah.
So Bud takes them outside, and the idea is now for the doctor and the nurse to go down the mountain and get the police and bring them back while Bud and Lou stall them. Well, Bud and Lou are not able to stall them long. Lou is first gets knocked out. I should mention Ginny Sims was here with the gangsters as well. Not part of them, but, you know, just kind of dragged along. And, you know, as Lewin gets knocked unconscious, she's very upset about it. And she helps them knock out the gangsters. Lou gets puts his hand in a vase and smashes it over, you know, a couple of the guys' heads. But when he can't get his hand out, he's got to smash it over his own head. That's a whole little joke there. We now get to the climax of Bud and Lou having to ski down the mountain ahead of the gangsters with the money. And again, shenanigans ensue. Lou is able to take out two of the three gangsters, send them down the mountain ahead of time, but he gets tangled up with Silk and they end up rolling down the hill in the center of a giant snowball. They catch up with the police down the mountain. The bad guys are arrested. Ginny is pleased. She wants to tell Lou that be the first to tell Lou that her and Johnny Long are getting married. But unfortunately, the way she says it, she says, she goes up and kisses Lou and says, "I want you to be the first to know we're getting married." And Lou thinks he's going to get married to Ginny Sims. And Bud obviously buys it as well, because we next see them, you know, sitting outside dressed to the nines, like they're going to be attending a wedding, which, of course, does not happen. You know, Luke's heart is kind of broken, and we get another nice little, you know, nice little song performed by, you know, Ginny Sims and her backup singers. And the last we see is Lou chasing, getting caught up in the train and almost being strangled to death because he said, "Let them hang me if I ever fall for another woman."
I have to admit, that physical gag made me wince a little, because it was just so, him being grabbed by the neck, I was like, "Oh, wow, okay." Luckily, it goes virally fast, but I was just, there's only so much physical pain I can watch Lou endure before I start wincing just a little bit.
Yeah, especially when, again, like in a lot of the movies, a lot of the physical pain is brought out because of Bud Abbott.
Right. He's slapping Costello. He's doing this or that. But him getting grabbed by the neck and like literally strung up, okay. But it goes by really fast, luckily.
But, you know, again, that's the image they leave on, too. They don't show, you know, Abbott coming to his rescue and bringing him down. He's still, you know, stuck up there as the credits start to roll.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's like, you know, in society. There's a scene in society when, you know, they're outside waiting for the cab, waiting for the cab driver. They're by the cab, and, you know, Bud keeps telling Lou to honk the horn. And a police officer comes running over and says, "You guys can't keep making this noise," to Lou. And Lou's like, "Okay." And Bud's like, "No, you honk that horn." Meanwhile, you know, the cops should be yelling at Bud, but he's yelling at Lou and threatening Lou. This is usually how I see the relationship between Bud and Lou. And that's why I enjoy this movie, where they're just so much closer friends, I guess I want to say. What is your favorite bit from the movie? I mentioned mine was, you know, the the rather sociopathic scene where they describe shooting everybody.
Mine is the shooting of them talking about shooting cops. It's just so
for free.
Like, what the hell?
Yeah.
And then like out mobbing the mob is just really too good. You know, where they're just like, yeah, we shoot them. Yeah, we shoot them for free. And they're like, it's just, you just, I just think, I mean, nobody does that kind of comedy now anyway, but if you tried, people would just be like, that's not funny, because it would be offensive. Now, that's easy to say. There's lots of stuff in old movies that are offensive nowadays, and it doesn't mean it's edgy. It just means that we've matured as a people. But those jokes are still, like, I laughed at it because it was so absurd, but I just think we would just regard that as just very different. So.
Right. Absurd, especially coming from them. No, 3 for 3 is my favorite scene as well. You know, especially, like I said, especially when I forget which one of the two henchmen is like, you shoot the back of their head and it doesn't count. Like, he was, you know, they were managing to they're managing to disturb the mafia. Yeah.
Well, even within, you know, like, again, towards at the end of the movie, at the confrontation with the cabin, when Costello has the gun, they're all kind of intimidated by him, mm-hmm. because he's really good at, you know, although they weren't afraid to knock him around a bit afterwards, you know, with the handkerchief bit that starts when, you know, Bud tells Lou that, yeah, well, I bet you I could stand on one end of the handkerchief and you could stand on the other and you wouldn't be able to touch me. And of course, the bid is to make sure the handkerchief is in the doorway and the door is closed, which Costello almost forgets in the when he tries to pull it off with the thugs. It's just the chemistry Bud and Lou had, it's just so astonishing to me to find out that, you know, there was so much animosity between them at times. I mean, I'm sure at times they must have got along. They must have, you know, probably got along, especially at the beginning. But, you know, I believe it was as the fame, you know, started to skyrocket, you know, Costello started looking like, you know, I'm the one, you know, being the butt of all the jokes and throwing myself around all over the place, you know, why am I not getting, you know, more of a share of the money, which of course is always going to cause problems between partners.
I can also see that, like, when we know like how much money their films are making, and the fact that even over the course of 10 years, like, Universal never really gave them any more money or more budgets. Like, they really kind of kept them working very cheaply, that I could sort of sit now. I mean, again, it's not an excuse for Lou to be kind of like a jerk or whatever, but you could see why he would start feeling very like, hey, what the hell? You know, I mean, we are massively popular, and we're like, you know, again, alongside Deanna Durbin, we are like Universal's biggest stars, and we're being treated kind of shabbily. So, you know, again, you shouldn't be a jerk about it, but I can see why. And especially Bud, what it sounds like, just from the stuff I read, that Bud was much more easygoing. I mean, he drank a lot and was difficult in different ways, but he just wasn't driven like that. I think he was just so thrilled to be living this life that he was like, eh, it's all good, you know? And it was Lou who was the one who was always like, we want to do this and that. And you know, I think that's tough to tolerate. I think if you're kind of pointed in two different directions, you know, about your career.
And I believe that Abbott was more secure in his standing because a good straight man was harder to find than a good funny man.
Yep.
So, you know, maybe he was just like, you know, I can find a guy to, well, whether he was thinking it or not, you know, if they want to replace Costello, I'm okay. Maybe Costello often felt like, you know, they might replace me with somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, just Abbott and Costello, I mean, again, this is, you know, they were, I think, voted the top box office draw shortly after this film by, like, the Theater Owners Association. you know, who would know by ticket sales on their own who sells more tickets. So it's hard to imagine that, you know, there was ever a time that Bud Abbott and Lou Costello weren't secure in their own fame. And, you know, because I think they made 28 pictures for Universal. And I believe this is somewhere around 8 or 9 as they went along. But, you know, I will sit and watch any Abbott and Costello film. There are some that, you know, I'm always a little disappointed in Go to Mars, not because they don't go to Mars, but I don't think it's one of their better films. But I will still watch it and be entertained. I will watch, you know, like I said, Buck Privates and what's their first one? A Night in the Tropics, where they're even more kind of second.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they are totally, yeah. I mean, they're there just to do their routines and then disappear. But, yeah, there's something very comforting about just, like, knowing each one is just going to be a set of, like, oh, okay, hit the ice. All right, we know what that's going to be. You know, like, okay, they're going to do winter sports. Oh, keep them flying. They're joining the Air Force. In the Navy. They're in the Navy. Like, it's like, you know the settings. You know, you can almost sort of, like, write it yourself, but it's still just really fun to watch. Because they're like, okay, what are they going to do now? What are both they going to do?
Yeah, I love Hold That Ghost. Hold That Ghost as
well. Oh, yeah, Hold That Ghost is great.
Because there's actually some scary moments spooky moments in Hold That Ghost, where you're watching and you're like, this is a little creepy for a slapstick comedy. As you know, things are moving around and, you know, dead bodies start showing up. All right, so unless we have anything else to say specifically about Hit the Ice, maybe we'll go into recommendations.
I'm good. I said I like it a lot. I think it's really solid. They would come back and do some other great films, but I don't know. It's tight. You know, it's like what? It's like 82 minutes or something. Like, they knew the runtime. I mean, obviously these are meant to be double features, but they knew, you know, there are no like 2-hour Abbott Costello movies, because that would just so wear out its welcome. But they just knew, get in, do the jokes. You know, and as you said, like, I do like that Bud and Lou are nicer together. I laugh when Bud is mean to Lou, but I do also enjoy when, like, oh, yeah, they're more like buddies. I appreciate that more.
Yeah. Well, and again, this is, you know, after a while, you would stop seeing the musical interludes coming. Yeah. Because I think that would just be not just with them, but also just come out of fashion in the films anyways. But I believe it's Hold That Ghost that has an amazing dance routine at a nightclub where the waiters and the chef jump up on this table and perform just these amazing feats that you would think, like, the table is covered with oil, the way they move their feet so effortlessly dancing around. But you also, like, if there was any oil on that table, they would slide off it when they jump on. But, you know, this is stuff you don't see anymore. So it's when I was a kid, I know I tuned out when Ginny Simmons would start singing, or the wait staff would start dancing. But now I'm absolutely fascinated by it. I believe it's Hold That Ghost. I don't remember exactly, but I'm going to.
Yeah, Hold That Ghost has some really good stuff. And I will say, for this film, my one criticism of, like, the part that I tune out is every time Patrick Knowles is talking. It's like every time he's in a movie, he's just kind of like the stiff. And that's not his fault. That's when he got cast. But, like, he's always just the guy who's like, all right, now the fun stops. Patrick Knowles is here. Like, okay. So he's the one who's like, you can't tell a patient what his temperature is. I'm like, what are we doing here? What is this?
Yeah, you almost wonder, you know, did they even need them after they got to the hotel? You know, it seems like they almost always need that guy who is Bud is the straight man, but it almost seems like they need that third person just to carry out those little bit of plot points between things so that Abbott and Costello can go do their shenanigans, and you just keep the plot moving. Yeah. And, like, yeah. That's all he's got to do. He's not really given a character. Much like in society, the fellow that the cute cab driver falls for. You know, she's only there to give her a romantic partner.
Yeah, I think they really like. I think they knew later on, like you said, like with Abacus Stello v. Frankenstein. Like, there's none of that, right? I mean, it's just it's Bud and Lou are front center. They kind of it's sort of when you think about how fast they're cranking out these movies. You know, they by the time they had released Buck Privates, they were already on like their fourth film. And they already have like three in the can, and they're filming the fourth one. So it's like it took them a while to like catch up and realize, oh, geez, you know, okay, we don't really need all these other side people that people want to see Bud and Lou. That's what we're here for. And it's like the Marx Brothers movies, you know, the early Marx Brothers movies, all these musical numbers. And it's like, who cares? Get to Groucho. And then by the time you get to Duck Soup, they drop all that. And it's like, no, the Marx Brothers are the reason you're here to see it. That's why you want to see it, is to see the guys.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, they would get into like the shenanigans, like, you know, you want to vary up, like, okay, now they're meeting the Keystone Cops. Now they're joining the Foreign Legion. You know, now they're in horse racing or whatever.
Yeah.
But yes, you really does become like the Wistful Widow of Wagon Gap is all about, really, Lou is the star of that one, with Bud almost being his sidekick. But yeah, they're other than the bad guys they're having to deal with and the widow herself, they've eliminated all the extras.
Yep.
So I'm gonna start with recommendations and say, you know, my other favorite Abbott and Costello movies are, as I mentioned, Hold That Ghost, Whodunit, and Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Whodunit is great. Whodunit is a really good one, and that's one of their lesser known ones. But that actually has some real directorial flair, and there's a murder in it, and it's got I would put that in like my top five, and that's not one that's generally very well known.
It's almost an Agatha Christie style murder, you know, the way, you know, it's plays out in front of everybody, yet they still have to figure out who done it. And then you almost got a Hitchcock style ending atop the roof as they battle with the bad guy.
Yeah. I will say the other one that I watch more often than others, and it's really just for one reason, is The Naughty 90s. And that's not one of their greatest films, but it has the best, most complete Who's on First.
Which is the one that runs the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Right, yeah. And so that's just for that reason alone, it's worth watching, because you're like, wow, this is flawless. You know, this is the absolutely perfect rendition of that routine.
It is perfect. You know, again, the way, you know, Bud dressed up in the manager's uniform with the bat, and even Lou's doing a little bit of, you know, again, physical comedy as he kind of, you know, moves around. I'll break your arm, you Susan. It is amazing routine. I remember the first time I heard it, I was in fifth grade. My teacher brought in the record, and I remember it had Who's on First, Horses Fodder, and Moby Dick. I'm sure it had other ones on there, but those are the ones I remember him playing. And that's when I really fell in love with Bud Abbott and Lou Costello, because I was laughing, and I remember there was a good portion of the class who was just like, ugh, our teacher brought this in. We can't find this funny. But it had me right from the beginning. All right, so I'm sorry. Was that the end of your recommendations?
I would say, yeah. I mean, again, I love a lot of their movies, but yeah, I like Buck Privates, obviously, Meet Frankenstein. Those are the Hold That Ghost are the most famous ones. But yeah, Whodunit is the one that I point. If someone said, "What's one that I haven't seen?" I would try. I mean, they're hard to find too. like they're not, they're, most of them are not available on streaming, unfortunately. The only ones that are, a lot of the ones that are like the ones that have fallen out of copyright. And there's a, like the color ones, and they're not particularly great ones.
Yeah.
But, you know, like them in Abbott Costello in Hollywood is pretty good. But who's the whodunit? I just feel like, oh man, they wish they had done five more this good, because this, that one's really great.
Yeah. Africa Screams is easy to find, but it's also not very good.
Jack and the Beanstalk, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah. Todd, do you have any recommendations?
No, not really. This is kind of out of my realm. I was but I definitely want to see Whodunit now.
Well, we got it.
Yeah, no, I don't, I'm definitely gonna check it out.
We one of the movies we plan on doing shortly is The Hidden. And, you know, I kind of like plan things out in my head before we know even watch the movie. And for some reason, because we were, I knew we were going to be doing this, I was like, what if The Hidden was an Abbott and Costello movie? With Costello in the Kyle MacLachlan role.
Right, of course.
And Abbott in the Michael Norrie role. And I'm like, you know, they could work in some of their routines in this, but it just, and it just, I went with it. Like I could just keep seeing like the different routines going on about it. And I'm working on a sketch. Maybe I don't know what we'll do with it, but I just, you know, Abbott and Costello in The Hidden.
I just, you've said a sentence that has never been said before and never will be said again. Lou Costello in the Kyle MacLachlan role. That those words have never been put in that order before.
Probably not, but maybe it'll catch on.
It could, you know.
Maybe Lou Costello could have gone on to star in Twin Peaks if he had still been alive.
I would watch the hell out of that.
All right, so another little thing we do is we, and I think I forgot to mention this to you, Rob, is we try to figure out a different title for this movie as though we are the owners of a 42nd Street cinema, and we're trying to make this a salacious, you know, we try to retitle the movie with the most salacious title we can possibly give it so people will come in to see it.
Hmm. I've heard you do this on the show. So I didn't know if you were going to have me do it, but I have heard you do it on the show before.
All right. Well, if you don't have one, that's fine. I don't know if Todd has one.
No, I don't. I thought we might skip it. Since
I have one, actually. I came up with one because I thought you might ask me.
Oh, brilliant.
I mean, it's not a great one, but I think you could call it Killers on Ice, where it's, you know, they pretend to be killers and they're on ice. So there you go. I mean, that's the kind of thing you would play as a second feature on, as you say, like 42nd Street in 1975.
I like it.
I came up with Gangsters on the Mountain of Death.
Wow.
On the Mountain of Death.
Right on. All right. Well, then that moves us to our final bit that we always do, is where we connect this movie to my favorite film, The Magnificent Seven, in Seven Steps or Less. Rob, I know you said you had one, so you can go first.
Right now, so you guys have, I don't think I've ever, I've heard, I listened to the show, so I don't know if I've, if I know the rule of that you can't, can you do TV? Is TV, does TV count?
TV's can actually count?
Yeah. Okay, okay, I didn't know whether that was the rule or not. So, okay, my connection's pretty fast, is that I would go from Bud Abbott, who was in the only thing Bud Abbott ever did without Lou Costello, after they were partnered, after they broke up, was he did a episode of General Electric Theater where he, in a drama, he played, he's not, it's not a comedy piece, it's a drama. And the name of the episode is called The Joke's on You, and his co-star is Lee Marvin. And of course, Lee Marvin did a ton of stuff with Charles Bronson, who of course was in The Magnificent Seven.
Is that available any way to see? I would love
it. It is on YouTube. You can watch it on YouTube. It is pretty amazing just to see Bud Abbott in a serious role, and just also like just seeing him with Lee Marvin. It's just like, what am I? You're just so not thinking of those two ever met, and yet there they are. So, yep, it's available.
I would love to see Lee Marvin in an Abbott and Costello movie, though.
He would have been a great gangster. Oh, by the way, you didn't ask me, but like my favorite actor in this that was not Button Lou is Sheldon Leonard, because Sheldon Leonard, of course, went on to like a longtime producer's career. He was an actor before this. He has 109 credits. I think he played a gangster in like 105 of those, and so he was just that guy. And so I liked him as what is his nickname? It's like Silky. He's so cartoony, and he's just like, hey boys, like the minute he shows up in one of these movies, I'm like, oh, I'm in good hands, because he's just going to be fun to watch.
Well, yeah, that's the whole point of the Whip Pistol Award, is that person that, you know, brings something out. Like, I know I'm, you know, when Strother Martin shows up, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, first of all, you're probably watching a Paul Newman movie, but second of all, you know, he's going to bring it. He's going to be entertaining in his role.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Todd, do you have a Magnificent 7 Degrees?
Yes, I do. So one of Silky's henchmen, the darker haired of the two, is Mark Lawrence. And Mark Lawrence was Tony Torpedo in Superfuzz with Ernest Borgnine, who was in Dirty Dozen with Charles Bronson.
Wow.
Magnificent Seven.
All right. Well, I had a couple, but I'm going to go with my quickest route, which is Abbott and Costello in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. There's a cameo, voice only, by Vincent Price, who plays the Invisible Man.
Right.
Vincent Price was in Master of the World with Charles Bronson.
Right on.
Mark Lawrence, right? The guy I picked, he's another one who's kind of like Sheldon Leonard. He's got a ton of acting credits. He's got like, you know, 40 acting credits between like 1930 and 1950. And he's like a gangster in just about every one of them. Yeah. He's one of those.
Yeah. We just saw him in Key Largo. We've been we went through the Bogey and Bacall filmography recently. That was a lot of fun.
Oh, those are great.
Well, unless anybody else has got anything they'd like to say.
No.
I'm good. Thank you for having me on to talk about this. I mean, I didn't think anyone would. I did an episode of Fade Out on Abbott Costello, which was great. I had it with an author, Nick Santamaria, who was a co-author of the annotated Abbott Costello, which was awesome. But, I mean, when they did 36 movies, you can only talk about so many. So it was great. I got to talk about one of the more obscure ones.
Yeah, Help Me Harry. Help Me Henry.
Dance with Me Henry is their last film. Yeah, Dance with Me Henry is their last film.
Together.
Yes, they're of course their last film together. Yes, because Lou would go on to do that awful 30 for Bride of Candy Rock movie.
Well, you know, and that used to play a lot around. We live in the Boston area, and that played a lot on the local channels around here. It was almost like every third weekend that would be on TV 56 on a Sunday afternoon,
it totally got packaged. It totally got packaged with all the Abbott Costello movies. I watched it I saw it just as many times as I saw the Abbott and Costello movies, even though it's not very good. But I watched it because I was a kid.
What is it?
It's called The 30-Foot Bride of Candy Rock. It's the only film Lou did by himself after Abbott Costello. And it's his last film because he died not long after that.
Oh, wow.
All right. Well, I really appreciate you joining us for this.
I love having you, man. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thanks so much, guys.
If you ever have time and want to come back, I know we discussed Tour of Duty.
great. Wow. We'd go from that to Tour of Duty. But that was a great show. That's an underrated show.
We will probably be doing that. We usually, when we cover a show, we'll do it like a season at each episode if we don't cover the entire... Like, when we covered the Brady Bunch, there was no need to break it down in multiple episodes. You know, the Brady Bunch was the Brady Bunch. But when we do Tour of Duty, we'll probably break it down that, you know, each season gets an episode as opposed to, you know, covering each episode of the show for an episode. We'll do season one. So if you're interested, I'll give you enough of a heads up to, you know, fit into your schedule.
With Lou Costello in the Terrence Knox
role. that's what came to mind too, was like Evan Costello in Vietnam.
I see
Costello. Hey, Captain!
And then the song and dance number, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
I see Costello more in the horn role.
Okay, all right. We can discuss that when we do the show.
All right, well, Rob, where can people find you? I mean, you're everywhere, especially on the Firewater Network. But
yeah, I mean, all my shows are on the Firewater Podcast Network. I have, as I mentioned, my shows, the show Fade Out, which you've been on, Matt. You were nice enough to be on.
And it was a great honor.
Thank you, thank you. We talked about Viva Knievel, one of my great... I don't even really believe in guilty pleasures, but it's as close to a guilty pleasure as can exist. Yeah, it's a really amazing movie. So I do Fade Out, and I do Treasury Cast, and I do Who's Who with Shag, and then my show Mashcast will be coming back soon, so I'm always over there.
All right, and if you're interested, you can follow us on social media. We're on Instagram, Threads, Blue Sky, X, formerly Twitter, and I think really I always encourage people to really follow us on Letterboxd because it's all about movies. It's so easy for me to just, you know, tell you what movie I've been recently watching, give it a star rating, and do a little review. Much like you, I like to do my star ratings on a sliding scale, basing how I rate the movie on what it is, as opposed to trying to compare Treasure of the Four Crowns to Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
Yeah.
They don't quite.
Not fair.
No.
It's not fair to Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
Right.
They don't have that epic scale model that do the whole assault, you know, planning on.
Oh, I want that model.
You can follow us on all of those at Movie Matt Sirois, all one word, MovieMattSirois. And as always, we thank you for listening and hope you have back next time.
Thank you, everyone.
Stay gold, people.